3 million. That's the number of court records researchers at Princeton University's Eviction Lab have been combing through to understand how evictions work in America. The lab released its findings this month, and here's what it found. In 2016 alone, landlords were given the legal right to remove nearly a million renters from their homes, and that's a low estimate. Emily Badger is a reporter for The Upshot at The New York Times, and she's on the phone to walk us through the data. Welcome, Emily.
Hi, Allison. Thanks for having me.
And in studio with us, we have organizers Randy Dillard and Susanna Blankley from the coalition Right to Counsel NYC. They organized tenants at risk of eviction, and last year they got the city to pass a law that ensures all low-income New Yorkers facing eviction have access to an attorney. We're going to dive into that a little bit. Randy and Susanna, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Emily, we're going to start with you because you're on the phone from California, and then we'll bring Randy and Susanna into the conversation. Emily, tell us about this database of evictions at the Eviction Lab in Princeton. A, how did the project start, and what's its mission?
So Matthew Desmond is a sociologist at Princeton who has been putting this together. And, you know, a lot of people may be familiar with him from this book that he published 2 years ago, Evicted, which, you know, really introduced this problem to a lot of people. It won a Pulitzer Prize. It was named, you know, one of their favorite books of the year by both Barack Obama and Bill Gates last year. And so it caused a lot of people to think for the first time about this problem of eviction and sort of how it reinforces cycles of poverty. But, you know, that book was based on Desmond's research in Milwaukee, sort of one city following about eight families as they were going through their housing troubles. And even Desmond could not tell us, you know, how widespread is this problem? Which cities have the highest eviction rates in America? You know, what are there some patterns among the places that have really high eviction rates? And that's because, you know, there really is no sort of national data that answers any of those questions for us. You know, the Census Bureau doesn't have, you know, some vast evictions database. You know, they don't have data on it in the same way that they have data on a lot of other questions about the housing market. You know, the government is not tracking this. So he set out with the team that he works with at Princeton to basically, you know, build this database himself by trying to collect millions and millions of individual court records. So this 83 million number that you referred to, these are eviction court records going back to 2000. So they span about 17 years worth of data. They come from all over the country. They're, so far, you know, this is an incomplete picture because it turns out in many states it's much harder to extract these records than in others. New York State is one of those places where the picture is more incomplete. But now we're able to say for the first time, you know, where are there hot spots of this problem? You know, what is it that might be happening there? And when we talk about a place that has an eviction problem, like how many renters are we talking about? And the numbers are really alarming. I mean, we're talking about some communities where as many as 1 in 10 renter households in a single year are receiving an eviction judgment in court.
Where are some of these high eviction rates and regions?
So this was a little bit surprising from the national picture. I think, you know, a lot of people might assume that we're seeing the most eviction in the most expensive cities because there's quite a lot of concern, you know, in California where I'm sitting, in New York, obviously, and in a lot of other sort of high-cost coastal cities, that the rapidly rising cost of rent is driving people out of their homes. And, you know, so I think that you would assume that we would be seeing a lot of eviction in Los Angeles and San Francisco and New York and Washington. But in fact, what we see on this map is that there's a lot of eviction happening in the Southeast, you know, happening in places where there's a lot of poverty, in places where there's a very large African-American population. And part of what this data suggests to me, and again, this is still an incomplete picture, is that, you know, a lot of eviction is happening in places where there just are not a lot of tenant protections. You know, there's not a lot of regulation of the landlord-tenant relationship in general, and to the extent that there is regulation of that, it tends to be much more in favor of landlords. So, you know, in a place like New York or Washington, D.C., for instance, yeah, it's very expensive, but there are also far more tenant protections and also a much stronger legal aid community in those places than is the case in, for instance, Richmond, Virginia, where I did a lot of reporting on this.
Okay, we're going to dive into Richmond in a little bit, but I do want to bring Susanna and Randy into this conversation. Just what you've heard Emily say, what really rings true to you about what she said so far, Susanna?
Yeah, that evictions are a cross-section of racial justice, economic justice, but also really about power in terms of who controls where we live and who has a say over our homes. So in New York, landlords try to sue anywhere from 250 to 300,000 households a year. That's about 1 million people. And when we looked at this crisis in New York through organizing in the Bronx around reforming the Bronx Housing Court that CASA did, and in Brooklyn with the Brooklyn Tenants United that was looking at the case of the Brooklyn Housing Court, we really saw the courts as a place where landlords had more power and control, and a place where landlords were evicting people when they wouldn't if tenants had attorneys.
Just to remind you, we're speaking with Susanna Blankley from the Right to Counsel NYC Coalition. Also joining us is Randy Dillard, also with the Right to Counsel NYC Coalition. So, Randy, how common is this in New York City? From your experience?
From my experience, I just found out about it about 4.5 years ago when I went to court and working with counsel, Susanna as the director, and they did a report tipping the scales. Mm-hmm. And then we found out that 90% of the landlords in housing courts had lawyers and tenants didn't. We found out that 3 out of every 4 tenants that went to court didn't even talk to a clerk inside the court. We found out that 41% of some of the tenants that went to court didn't even talk to a judge. And we also found out that tenants didn't know anything about the courtroom, just like I didn't know anything about the courtroom.
Yeah, I want to ask you, would you mind sharing your personal story with us?
Yes. My landlord took me to court for a non-payment of rent that I did not owe. I had a Section 8 voucher. Section 8 came into my apartment. They did the repairs to my apartment, came in, did the inspection. And they found out that the landlord hadn't did repairs to my place. So they stopped paying them their portion of my rent, but I had to keep paying my portion of my rent. And I got sick, and I went to the hospital. I almost died, like I tell everybody. When I came out, my landlord served me with papers. I'm a single parent with 5 children, and my 5 kids was in the hallway when my landlord's lawyer served me papers. And they was looking at me, and I was looking at them, and they wanted an answer to, after the landlord's lawyer left, with, Daddy, what we going to do?
Wow.
In my mind was being homeless and going to the shelters.
Of course.
And I was fortunate that in my neighborhood that there was a POTS part of the solution where I went and got a lawyer. Mm-hmm. I was fortunate that CASA was there, where Susanna was the director at the time, that I went in there to learn what my rights was. I was in court for 2.5 years. Section 8 had stopped my portion of Section 8 because of one of the violations that they had stopped paying the landlord for. Mm-hmm. The mental effect that it has on it, my daughter was a B student. She dropped from B's to D's and F's, thinking that she was going to go to a shelter. My landlord was so bold that he arrested my son. You understand, we found out that we had cameras in the neighborhood to show that the police was lying. So you go through a lot.
You've been through it.
Yes, yes.
You've been through it.
You go through a lot dealing with a slumlord.
Yeah. Emily, I want to bring you back in. So, something that was very interesting about what Randy said is it's not just the eviction that's the problem. That just sets off a series of events in people's lives. Can you walk through that a little bit for us?
Yeah, I mean, this is why this problem is such a big deal, because it's not just sort of one problem in and of itself, that someone's not paying their rent, they can't pay their rent, and so, you know, they get taken to court. Like, there's this long story that happens for every single one of these households after they come out of court with an eviction judgment on their record and having to leave their home. And, you know, so you see, you know, there are consequences for children, exactly as Randy was describing with his own daughter. You know, when children don't have stable homes, they are much less likely to be able to concentrate and perform well in school. You know, there are consequences for adults. If you get evicted from the home and, you know, the bus stop by that home was how you got to your job, and, you know, now you no longer have access to that transit line, maybe that's going to cost you your job. You know, I've heard lots of cases of, you know, people who received public benefits of some kind, whether it was Medicaid or food stamps. You know, every year you may get some piece of paper in the mail that tells you, you know, now it's time for you to renew renew your eligibility for this. Well, if you lose your address, you lose your ability to get a piece of mail like that, and as a result, you may lose your SNAP benefits, you may lose your Medicaid. You know, there are just these cascading consequences, and one of the things that I realized in discovering that a bunch of communities have a tremendous amount of this housing instability is that these ripple effects, you know, they add up not just for individual people, but they add up for entire cities. So, you know, now what happens when you have an entire school district where a large share of children have housing instability and are unable to learn? You know, what happens when you're running a social services department and you can't keep track of the people that you're trying to help? I mean, these really big picture macro consequences really add up, and they all stem back at the end of the day to, you know, this one court decision that happened at one moment in time.
Susanna, when people get evicted in New York, where do they typically go?
Well, during the campaign, the number one reason people went into the shelter system was evictions. And I think one of our main concerns in New York is, you know, challenges that people in San Francisco are facing is, do you leave the city or can you stay in your neighborhood? And I think we're facing a time in New York where if you are evicted, it's less and less likely that you can stay in your neighborhood. And I think one thing to remember, too, is that, you know, it's not just about rent or tenants being behind in rent. In New York, part of the foundation of the campaign was really thinking about how landlords use the threat of eviction also outside of the court. So before a case ever starts, landlords will sue people or give them a, before they sue people, they'll give them a rent notice or a rent demand letter. And oftentimes, because tenants know before Right to Counsel passed in New York that the courts really worked in the favor of landlords, they knew that they were less likely to win their case if they fought it. And so often people were moving out because of the threat of eviction, that actually the power that landlords have goes beyond the courts. And there were pilots that showed that of the tenants that were evicted, anywhere from 50 to 80% of tenants who were evicted wouldn't have been evicted if they had attorneys.
I'm going to ask a screamingly obvious question to you. Why are the courts favoring the landlords?
Very good question.
They're giving each other the eye over there.
Well, one reason is that, I mean, historically, landlords have representation in housing court. So before Right to Counsel, less than 10% of tenants had a lawyer in housing court, and something like 90 to 97% of landlords had attorneys in housing court. So when you think about the vast, you know, the depth of the law in New York, the landlord-tenant law, who has access to that law? Who's using it in the court system? And the judges are there to be neutral. They can't advocate on behalf of one person or one party. And so when you have that kind of imbalance of justice in a court system that's supposed to represent our institutions and the laws that are really a reflection of struggle, that tenants really organized to get so many protections in New York, it leads you to think that we have to actually look at who's controlling the courts and where we can impact that. For example, that's why we fought for Right to Counsel, to think about how can we have power in that space, and also how can we transform the nature of that court so that it's not just a court where landlords are suing tenants, but it's a court where tenants can find justice, where they can sue landlords around repairs.
Fight back. Yeah.
Exactly.
The Evictions Lab estimates about half the evictions in the U.S. don't even really get to court. You touched on that. So there's just not this paper trail. So, Randy, what are other ways that landlords are kicking tenants out without going to court?
They scare them. They tell them they got 72 hours to get out, and some of them just leave. They give you a piece of paper that you can't even read. Some of them don't even go to housing court. And that's when they come up with a default. Tenants don't know if you don't show up that you automatically lose the case, so you're automatically out. And then they scare you and tell you that they're going to send the marshals to put you out, and maybe some of them are not going to send the marshals to put you out, and then they leave automatically.
We're speaking with Emily Badger, a reporter for the New York Times, as well as Randy Dillard and Susanna Blankley from the Right to Counsel NYC Coalition. We're talking about the eviction crisis in the United States. Stick around. We'll talk to them more after the break. I'm Allison Stewart, and we're speaking with Susanna Blankley and Randy Dillard of the Right to Counsel NYC Coalition and New York Times reporter Emily Badger about the eviction crisis hitting the United States. And we're also talking about it specifically here in New York. We've been throwing around this Right to Counsel law, Susanna and Randy, and I want to make sure people understand. You know, I think most people think, doesn't everybody have a right to a lawyer when you go to court? Mm-hmm. And that wasn't the case. Can you explain what was the law and what you worked to change and when that took effect?
Yeah, so there was no law that made it a right for tenants to have an attorney when they were facing eviction. And frankly, there is no law anywhere in the country except for New York that just passed the first law of its kind last August.
Is that because of the kind of court it was? Because it's civil court versus, why was that?
Well, so, I mean, you know, I think people think that because you have a right to an attorney in criminal cases, you have a right to an attorney in other kinds of cases. Gotcha. But that's actually not true. And so housing court is a part of the civil court of New York. So when we think about the right to an attorney in eviction cases, we're also talking about a new civil right that just was created in this city. And so the Right to Counsel Coalition formed in June of 2014. We looked at legislation, local legislation, that would make it a right for tenants to have an attorney when they're facing an eviction in housing court. Councilmember Mark Levine and Councilmember Gibson in the Bronx sponsored that legislation. A lot of folks had worked on other kinds of legislation around representation in housing court in the past, housing court reforms, but this really was the first legislation of its kind. And the coalition formed to really launch a campaign. We had a 3-year campaign. We did a lot of actions. We had a huge hearing at City Hall. We collected many signatures. We had an interfaith forum. We did a lot. We had a financial study that shows that eviction defense, once it's fully implemented, will not only pay for itself, but it will save the city more than $300 million a year. That eviction defense is really an investment, not a cost. So we did a lot to really build the support for this groundbreaking new legislation. It was passed in August. It's being implemented over 5 years. So it'll be fully implemented by July of 2022. It's being phased in over the next 5 years to give the nonprofit legal services providers who are doing
to ramp
this great
up
work.
And, yep. And be able to be there and yep. be available. So, Randy, you had a lawyer when you went to court. What difference do you think that made?
It made a big difference because I was able to relax knowing that I had someone telling me what was wrong and why I was there, and be able to talk to the landlord's lawyer and the judge. That it was a big difference in having a lawyer there. As this bill passed, you know, now we know that this law would keep tenants out of shelters. We know this law would help senior citizens. We know this law would help disabilities people. Mm-hmm. It would help people like me to organize my building. It would help us not to be afraid of the landlord, that we know that we can take the landlord to court. You know, this is a great victory.
Okay.
For tenants.
Thanks so much. We're going to have, we're going to talk to some landlords calling in. We're going to talk to them in a minute, bring them on the line, hear their point of view. A lot of people are saying it's very costly for landlords as well. But Emily, I want to bring you in because we mentioned at the top of the show that Richmond, Virginia has the highest concentration of evictions. And you visited court in Richmond, and you've heard what the experience has been for Randy here in New York. Tell us a little bit what the experience was like in Richmond and why you decided to drill down there.
What I saw in Richmond was, a very clear example of what Susanna referred to earlier as this, like, incredible imbalance of power in the courtroom. So very, very few people have lawyers. Tenants don't have lawyers. Invariably, property managers or landlords show up with lawyers. So, you know, you have some people there who are very familiar with the system. You know, all of the lawyers know each other. They know the judges. You know, even the lawyers who are there, you know, doing legal aid, and the lawyers who are there representing property managers, like, they know each other. You know, everyone knows the rules except for the people who are walking in there potentially going to be evicted. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really unrealistic to think that people could navigate this complicated legal system without someone holding their hand through it. I mean, sort of, you know, regardless of what your knowledge of the legal system is, it's incredibly intimidating. And because these courts are looking at dozens of eviction cases, you know, on a docket at any given day, these cases happen, you know, really quickly. Like, your case may come before a judge and be done in 2 minutes. And that's certainly not enough time to sort of process what's going on, to ask questions, to even understand if you're allowed to ask questions. And, you know, my experience in Richmond, one of the first things I did when I got to town there was I went down to the courthouse and had this terrible experience just trying to get in the door of the courthouse there, because it turns out you can't bring your cell phone into the courthouse. You know, you can't bring a bottle of water into the courthouse. You can't bring a phone charger into the courthouse. And so, you know, people show up not knowing this, and then it turns out that they can't even get through the metal detector at the door, and, you know, people are having to tuck their cell phones in the bushes and under trash cans outside. And I met one woman who, you know, in the process of doing that, wound up missing her court date, which happened, you know, very, very quickly inside because she was just trying to get in the door. And to me, that was this very sort of perfect distillation of how, you know, here is this process that is very cumbersome, that's daunting. People don't know how to navigate it, and we're certainly not making it easy for people to do that. You know, when you get a summons to go to court in most places for an eviction case, you know, you don't get like a handy little FAQ that's delivered with it that tells you, you know, make sure you don't bring your cell phone to court. You know, make sure you, you know what you should bring with you, and these are the expectations that you should have, and this is exactly how the process is going to play out. You know, no one is thinking about like, what, you know, what kind of customer service should we be providing to people who are entering this really daunting process.
Now, we know evictions are life-shattering for tenants, but they aren't always easy for landlords either. I know you spoke to some landlords in Richmond. What about folks who are doing a good job of keeping up their properties and they have people who are just consistently delinquent on their rent? What's their recourse?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is absolutely not the case that this is a problem where landlords universally are some kind of villain. You know, landlords are bad, tenants are good. You know, it's a much more complicated situation than that. I absolutely believe that, you know, there are slumlords in every city in America who are profiting off of the poor by renting out properties that they know they are not taking care of. But it's also absolutely the case that there are landlords who, you know, try to do everything right. They are taking care of their properties. You know, they try to give tenants first and second chances. They have mortgages to pay, so, you know, they have problems as well. And so to me, this entire problem is much more complicated than just sort of vilifying the landlords. And, you know, one point that someone made to me after we published the story, which you know, really sort of resonated with me, was that, you know, because a lot of this problem is caused by these larger forces where, you know, maybe the minimum wage is too low, there are not good job opportunities for people, school systems aren't, you know, preparing children to grow up and have good jobs. Like, these are much larger problems in society, and to some extent, you know, it's not really fair to expect landlords alone to sort of bear the brunt of all of those problems that are created beyond them. So I think, you know, just as we want to be able to distinguish between a landlord who habitually doesn't pay the rent, who's intentionally flouting their lease, and, you know, the tenant who has sort of a one-time problem, you know, maybe they have a medical situation, they can't pay their bill. You know, we also want to be able to distinguish between the fact that there are different kinds of landlords out there.
You know, I know Richmond pretty well. I have family in Richmond, and there's an interactive map on the New York Times website. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you see it, the evictions are all in the historically black communities. Mm-hmm. It's just the West End of Richmond, there aren't any. And the laws in Virginia, and I think you pointed this out in your piece, Emily, is that they're meant for white male landowners, right, historically. So there is part of history in this. And the city's most evictions are in Virginia, and 8 out of 10 are in the South. Mm. So there is a component of race in this, isn't there?
I think there's, you know, there race is embedded throughout this problem. You know,
right.
It's embedded in the fact that, you know, tenants who, you know, who are living in poverty, who are less likely to be able to pay their bills, you know, they are more likely to be African American or to be, you know, people of color who have not had economic opportunity. You know, it's embedded in the fact that African Americans in Richmond and a lot of other places are living in sort of the worst quality housing stock because they have been relegated to that by sort of generations of segregation. And, you know, these other kind of long-term forces in the housing market. But then I also think it's true that when we're talking about laws at the level of state legislatures and whether or not we're willing to grant more protections to this class of people, you know, I think that race plays a role in that as well. You know, this is true anytime we're talking about sort of creating greater protections for the poor. You know, people's ideas about who is poor and how race fits into that and whether or not, you know, people are deserving of aid when they're poor, you know, those are sort of inseparable from ideas about race in America as well.
I see you're nodding, Susanna, to what she's saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's a very strong narrative of deserving versus undeserving.
Mm-hmm.
But even in this fight around right to counsel, like, who deserves an attorney? Are they a good tenant or a bad tenant? And I think that's a It's a narrative that's seeped in racism. It's a narrative that's seeped in class. And I think we have to confront that narrative all the time, that we have to remember that part of the challenge, too, is that we're talking about housing as a commodity, a thing that people make profit off of, as opposed to people's homes. Like when Randy talked about it, he talked about it as the place that was safety for his children. Mm-hmm. And we have to remember that housing is a home first.
And Emily, something that also struck me in your reporting, and Susanna, you might know more about this as well, is the sums of money are not enormous, right? Sometimes it's not thousands and thousands of dollars in some cases, right, Emily?
No, I mean, the median amount of money that we were talking about in Richmond was only about like $650. And the Public Housing Authority in Richmond was one of the larger landlord evictors in the city. And the median eviction in public housing there was only about $300. You know, if you show up in court on any given day and you look at the sums of money on the docket, sometimes we're talking about $50 or, you know, $200. These are really small sums of money where if we could find ways to get tenants the money that they need to bridge them for a particular month when they're falling behind, you know, that could stave off all of these other consequences that we're talking about.
Yeah, they're not, I mean, that's not a small amount of money, but it's not the kind of money you think that someone's entire life is going to fall apart over, right? Mm. Let's talk about the law. I want to know what changes. Have you noticed any changes since the Right to Counsel law has been enacted, either of you, Randy or Susanna?
So we've seen evictions go down. So in the ramp up to passing the legislation, there was increased funding for tenant attorneys in New York, and we've seen evictions decrease, but we've also seen filings decrease, meaning the amount of cases that landlords are bringing to court has actually also gone down. And we hope that we will continue to see that as Right to Counsel expands, as more and more people know about it, as more and more people assert their rights, as more people organize, as more people to say, I'm not going to accept this threat from my landlord, go ahead, take me to court, I'll call your bluff on that. Mm-hmm. As more and more people do that, we think landlords will sue people less, and we think the data is bearing that out. And so I think it's really important to think about not just the law in terms of evictions, but how tenants can use this law to really build tenant power, because the fear of evictions has been an impediment to organizing. And one of the reasons we fought for this was to say, we need to fight to stay, not just to stay, but to build a different kind of city where we're thinking about solutions like community land trusts, like greater renter protections. We need tenants to stay to fight for those things, because the problems that are causing evictions are bigger than Right to Counsel, but Right to Counsel is a key piece in that fight.
Emily, have you reported any other innovative strategies for tackling the eviction crisis?
Yeah, you know, one of the most promising ideas that Matt Desmond, the sociologist at Princeton, was telling me about was, you know, some communities where you have these community courts where, you know, a tenant shows up in court and, you know, you have representatives of your various social service providers there as well. And one of the questions that's asked in court is, why are you getting evicted? Why did you fall behind on your rent? And, you know, that is a really important question that almost never comes up in court. You know, that's the question that brings out, you know, the stories about, you know, my car broke down and I had no other way to get to work and I had to spend my rent money on car repairs. This has never happened before. It's never going to happen again. Or, you know, I you know, had a family member who died and I spent my rent money on funeral costs. I mean, when you ask that question, we start to sort of get at what are the human problems that are really causing people to be in this position in the first place. And, you know, in some community courts, you know, people's answer to that affects the outcome. You know, perhaps your problem is that, you know, you're a seasonal worker and your hours got cut. So then, you know, maybe what we want to do in court is refer you to some kind of employment program. Or perhaps your problem is that you previously had an addiction and you've relapsed. Well, maybe what we want to do in court is say, oh, this person needs to be referred to some kind of addiction treatment services. You know, we could be identifying the root causes of why people are failing to pay their rent when that happens and trying to tackle those and work something out with landlords. And, you know, that would be a very different situation and produce very different outcomes from simply, you know, sort of having this assembly line situation where massive numbers of cases are coming into court. Most of them are default judgments because people don't show up and they don't have representation. And, you know, then we're just having all of these enormous problems that stem from that.
Randy, you're someone who's been through this entire process. Aside from the right to counsel and having a lawyer, what are one or two small things that could have gone differently for you that you think are small adjustments that would have a big impact for people who are going through evictions?
Well, one thing, like we was talking about earlier, that when tenants go to court, like she was saying, if you knew that you got access to get money that when you're in the rear, and we find out some tenants, when the summertime come, that they have air conditions, so that stops them from paying their bills, being able to pay the landlord. Sometimes it's part-time job, sometimes they got child care, you know, and they can't pay their bills. You know, it's a lot that they look at us and say that, you know, we lazy, we don't want to pay our rent, we want to just to try to get over on the landlords. But it's a lot of things. Some single parents got 2 and 3 kids that might need clothes, anything that stops them from paying their landlords. There's a lot of different reasons other than conning, people thinking that you're trying to con the landlord to keep from paying your rent. People, you got people that we've come in contact with the Right to Counsel and with CASA Community Action for Safe Apartments, that people have kids, you understand, and they have more than one, and some of them have 2 or 3 jobs, and that they can't pay that high rent sometimes. We find out that sometimes landlords put you out, you understand, so they can get that apartment to jack up that rent
That was going to be my next question to you, Susanna. In terms of cities like New York, where gentrification, the G word, is happening, how is that playing into all of this? And before you answer, I do want to give people our phone number. I didn't get to give it earlier. 212-433-9692. If you want to join the conversation, please do. 212-433-9692. Susanna, back to the idea of gentrification's role in all of this.
Yeah, you can separate gentrification, of course. And I think that, you know, for us, housing court and evictions were a piece of the struggle. They were a way that landlords displace people, but in part because they want to get higher rents. So I think another question we have to think about is, why is rent so high in the first place? Mm-hmm. And why should folks be working so hard to pay a high rent that gives profit to landlords? And so I think we have to look at how are evictions being used and who is benefiting from those evictions, and also what are the larger structures that lead to such high housing costs. We talked about racial discrimination. We have to look at our history of redlining, of urban renewal, of the consolidation of land ownership in this city and in the country. Matt was on Democracy Now, and he talked about Blackstone. So looking at the investors that look at housing as an investment and are trying to flip and evict tenants as part of their business model in order to get white, wealthier tenants in to pay higher rents. And that is a large and huge problem that's global, that's affecting our city, that's affecting cities across the country. I did just want to give a shout out to some San Francisco, Newark. Other cities are also really looking at Right to Counsel as a tool to fight gentrification and displacement.
It is a complex and layered issue. We thank all of you for walking us through it today. We appreciate it.